that we could identify as problems of time have been solved or have been solved in outline so that we can see how the solution would go. And that in particular, combining the notion of history with the notion of discrete space-time in the causal set way allows us to give a very concrete illustration of the things I'm talking about. So the structure of a causal set is simple enough that these problems of time, such those that you might regard as still remaining in the history's formulation, emerge with great clarity, and one could see in what sense I'm claiming that they're solved. So that's kind of the agenda. Please interrupt at any time with questions. This being a class, including, this is Western, right? Hi, that's Western, okay. Okay, so let's start with what is the problem of time? And I guess that's what the whole class has been about, but I've missed the lectures up till now. So although I did look at a little bit of one on Pearce last night, but let me say what I think you probably mean by the problem of time. In fact, I want to list about 5 or 6 different aspects of it. Where should I do that? Maybe here. Starting with the most blatant one, and the one that I think most people have in mind when they refer to the problem of time. Well, maybe I'll just put the list over here. So, the problem of time, I'm going to list about 5, end up with about 5, but let's start with the first one, occurs within canonical quantum gravity. And I think that's something you have discussed in a fair amount of detail. So I'll just review the situation, which is that quantizing gravity in the most familiar way, canonical quantization, doing the same thing that you would have done for the hydrogen atom, leads to something peculiar, which is a wave function. It's now a functionale, which depends on a three-dimensional metric. It leads to a wave function, which depends on the metric, all right, which is the analog of the position or Q, but it has no time dependence anymore. If you give it formally time dependence, then the constraint, the Hamiltonian constraint, tells you that the time dependence is trivial. This is in, here I'm thinking in this so-called geometrodynamic formulation in which one views the gravitational, one views the Einstein equations as describing the development of a three-dimensional metric in time with extra information given by lapse and shift in order to fully pin down the space-time geometry. But the same is true also in the loop formulation. One doesn't have a three metric here, one has something else. But in the end, instead of this whole thing, maybe one has a linear combination of spin networks or something like that. But in the end, there's again no parameter time in it. So this thing that they call sometimes the frozen formalism, that T is just absent, it's not in the story. And it seems as if it's saying that there's no time at all. And because of that, there's the problem of time, which is how to recover time from space, or how to recover time from space-time. Now, I want to, maybe I will put this up here. I'm just making a little list of the different problems. So the very first is recover time or space-time from space that's in canonical quantum gravity. Okay. Now, I actually don't think that this problem has a solution when it's posed like that. That's the reason I became interested in history's formulation long ago. It wasn't necessarily the only reason, but it's the reason that I remember Lee and I sort of crossed at the same time I was thinking in canonical formulation, he was thinking in terms of histories and graph integrals, and then we sort of changed places. He also changed places physically by coming to Syracuse, but I stayed there. At least we didn't cross in that way. So, as I said, I don't think that it really ultimately has a solution, but I want to mention, just by the way of an aside, a partial solution, very partial solution that comes from what's called unimodular gravity. That might be interesting, but in the end, we'll see that it doesn't solve the problem. But since I think you've been concerned a lot with this kind of question, you might like to see the what unimodular gravity has to offer. I won't try to describe the whole what unimodular gravity actually is in detail. From a path integral point of view, you can think of it as an extra constraint in which one holds fixed in the path integral not only the metric on the boundary, but also the total volume of the region that one is integrating over. And that volume which one holds fixed plays the role of time. So this is, I put a 4 here to show that this is space-time volume, or 4 volume. That plays the role, I'll just write equal, t, it plays the role of a time parameter. When you do the integral holding this fixed, then you can ask how the result depends on this parameter, and that gives a kind of, that inserts a kind of extra parameter into the wave function, giving it a time dependence. So what you get when you do the integral that way, you now have a picture that you might have in mind is something like some initial surface, some final hypersurface, and V is the volume of the region that one is integrating over. It's playing the role of time. The equation of motion that comes out of that looks then like a Schrodinger equation. It looks like this. So I'm taking the partial derivative in which I hold fixed the 3 metric on the boundary, but integrate over this time, this volume time. It's equal to the Hamiltonian constraint, to make it a hat, I guess, acting on psi. So instead of having this as 0, I now have it gives the derivative with respect to t, where, but not for an arbitrary choice of Laplace function, but only for one that integrates to 1. Here, I don't know what convention you've been using, but I guess I'm using a densitized Laplace, so I don't have to include the square root of minus g, or square root of g plus g, in this case, in the integral. You might say, well, there's very many. Which one of the n's that integrates to 1? It doesn't matter because, and here's why we don't solve the problem of time, really. There used to be an infinite number of Hamiltonian constraints because you can smear it with any Laplace function at all. There's still an infinite number. We've just lost one of them. And so the others remain. And look exactly like that. Like you're used to, except with now, we have not a completely arbitrary Laplace, but one which equals 0. So in other words, it's the kind of Laplace function that, if here's your hypersurface, and here it is after the Laplace has acted on it, pushed it forward or backward, it's a kind of one, this represents the change in the volume. And so that is the space-time volume to the path of the hypersurface. And so this is exactly the kind of Laplace that wouldn't change the volume. And therefore, the usual arguments for why the wave function can't change due to general covariance apply. Okay. So this, you still keep an infinite number of constraints. And so you recover only a tiny little bit of time. Time in this phrase that people use is many fingered. And all the fingers were lost here. Here we got one finger, but we still haven't got the other infinity minus one fingers. It is interesting, though, that for cosmology, and really here I mean for a very special case of cosmology, homogeneous cosmology, homogeneous isotropic, this mini superspace cosmology, in that case, you only need one time because you have a unique slicing up to parameterization of the slices. And so in that case, so this is Friedman cosmology I'm talking about, or FRW. In that case, you do solve the problem of time. This is the, I'll call it POT1. Right, this one, the first problem of time. We do recover space-time, and you can actually do quantum cosmology that way, and there are some interesting results. However, this still doesn't let you ask most of the questions you'd like to ask. You still can't, in any obvious way, ask about a black hole horizon, for example. Because the black hole horizon is something which makes sense only with respect to a space-time, not just with respect to space at a given time. And this, except in the special case where you have a unique, almost unique slicing, like in this special case here, in general, having this one little bit of time still doesn't give you a space-time back, just because you can have the wave function depend on that one extra parameter. There's also some problems, if you think about it, where this is going to give trouble in an asymptotically flat setting. But I don't want to say too much more about the unimodular. That's a bit of a sidetrack, but it is interesting. And it was historically thought by some people for a short time to actually be the solution to the problem of time. But it just doesn't go far enough. So that's the first and most, I think, most troublesome problem of time that people talk about. But we can say more. Well, let me ask, are there any questions on what I've just said about? I'm not quite sure what a background to assume. No. Some puzzled looks, but no questions.
I have a very, very tiny question. Okay. Just approximately what year was unimodular gravity? Is it 91 or?
Well, some form of it goes back to very early times, a paper by Einstein in, I don't know, 1920 or something. I mean, in that form, they were looking around for convenient gauge conditions or convenient coordinate conditions. And some people, I'm not sure who it is exactly, used the gauge condition that this would be one. So they thought of that as just a coordinate condition.
Oh, that's 1912, 1913.
1912, okay, but early, even before General.
Before that
was considered. Then at some point, I think in connection with the cosmological concept, but I'm not sure I'm remembering the history right, that Einstein suggested a modified set of field equations, which correspond to the unimodular, which are exactly the field equations that you get from unimodular formulation of general relativity. The relation to the cosmological constant is with those field equations, because you lost one variation that you're allowed to do. Now I'm thinking in the path integral way. In the path integral way, if you write down an action principle, you say specify this metric here, specify the metric here, vary the metric in between absolutely freely, what comes out is the Einstein equations. If you say vary the metric subject to this unimodular constraint, that the total volume be a certain number, then you lose one, you lost one variation, so you lose one equation. And that's compensated, and so an extra integration constant comes in to the equations, and that can be identified as the cosmological constant. So you sort of remove the problem of the cosmological constant in a sense that it's not forced to any particular value, but you still have no clue why it's so near zero. But it's just a free constant of integration. So I don't know the exact history, but it came up in that form. And then I suppose around 1980 or early 80s or something, no, late 80s probably, was when people started reviving that idea. And in connection with the problem.
I remember reading papers in the late 80s at this
time. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, so that was unimodular gravity. As a very small, solving a very small piece of the problem. But let's step back a little bit and ask, where did this problem really come from? Most people would probably answer that by saying, and I think I would agree with them, that the origin of that problem is the diffeomorphism invariance of general relativity. So when I say diffeomorphism invariance, I mean the whole four-dimensional diffeomorphism invariance, not just the three-dimensional diffeomorphism. Sometimes in the context of canonical gravity, one talks about diffeomorphism constraint and so on. And they mean only the three-dimensional piece. But I'm talking about the full diffeomorphism invariance of four-dimensional general relativity. And I think I sort of said it already, although I unfortunately hit it. One can trace the fact that the wave function of ordinary, not getting the modular, let's go back to ordinary general relativity, the fact that the wave function in the end doesn't depend on any kind of time parameter, can be traced to diffeomorphism invariance. Because if you use, again, if you think in a path integral way, you think of producing a final wave function, say psi, on this hypersurface, starting from some initial wave function, psi naught. I won't write the formula out, right? No, because I think I'll write it later. Just remind you, this is, I assume, familiar to everyone. But you formally write, I will write it in a minute. So you formally write, these are four metrics now, so there's some confusion there. This is meant to be the measure factor. So this is the integral over all four metrics. E to the I, S of the four metrics. And psi naught of the three metric, the notation is a little bad. I could make it better, but it would get a little bit more cumbersome. So this means, of course, four metrics that induce the metric, the given three metric, 3g on the initial boundary. And that gives you psi of 3g final. So I've got to give this, I guess I have to call this not. Anyway, I take it it's all very familiar. So you start with a three metric on the initial boundary. You integrate over all four metrics, this e to the I action, all the four metrics that agree with that initial metric, and also agree with the final metric at which you're aiming to evaluate the final wave function. And that sum of all those amplitudes is the final wave function. Formally, of course, whether this really can be given a precise meaning is another question entirely. But if you take it formally, then, and that's good enough, I think, for understanding why certain things happen in canonical gravity. If you take it like that, then you can immediately, and compare two things, you can immediately see where this frozen formalism comes from. The first thing is that the Hamiltonian has the effect of pushing the hypersurface a little bit forward or backward, the integrated Hamiltonian constraint, just like in this picture here. But the second thing is that it doesn't matter if you push the hypersurface a little bit forward or backward, because we've already integrated over all metrics here. And if we now push it forward and integrate over all metrics between here and here, what's the difference, right? Because this space, this portion of space-time is diffeomorphic to this portion of space-time. Unless you assume that the measure factor breaks the diffeomorphism invariance, which would mean that you would lose g general covariance, then these have to give the same result. So pushing the final hypersurfaces forward or backward in time, or a mixture of forward and backward like this, can't change the value of the wave function. That has to show up in the canonical formulation, and the way it shows up is in terms of the Hamiltonian constraint. That the thing which would push the wave function forward or backward actually vanishes. Okay, so there's a very direct line between diffeomorphism invariance and this frozen character of the canonical formalism. Notice, however, that nothing was frozen about the individual space-times that I put in there. It's what got frozen was the wave function. So if we can find another way of thinking where we focus on the space-time and not on the wave function, we may solve the problem of time. And that's exactly what I'm driving at, or what I'm going to claim happens. But let's not quite go there yet. So a somewhat more general idea of what the problem of time is conceptual problems arising from diffeomorphism invariance. So I somewhat generalized the notion of problem of time from this very specific one that's peculiar to a particular formulation of gravity, the 3+1 as a canonical formulation. I'll push it to just general, see, how do I want to say? So conceptual problems coming from the diffeomorphism invariance of general relativity. And of those conceptual problems, let me highlight one of them, which is, this I claim follows from it. But even if we don't work in the canonical formalism, there's a more general question, which is, now I have a problem with words, but many people would say observables. Some people don't like this because it suggests a particular approach to quantum mechanics, a kind of operationalist or whatever approach that's called. So I'll put some alternative words. This one that Bell introduced, which I used to think was, what a strange word, a beeble. But then I realized that it's actually a be able. So instead of being something which you can observe, it's something which can exist. So beables are the most neutral term, is just, I think, maybe variables. What are the meaningful statements that one can ask about a quantum space-time? So they have to be covariant. Well, here I'm putting more in the summary. I should put that on the other board. But they have to be covariant, and moreover, they have to be meaningful. In other words, they're not just some formal mathematical thing that you can write down, but you have to understand something about what they are telling you physically. Otherwise, you'll never know how to look for them or check it against the theory. I think maybe you discussed some of that issue. So the second aspect of the problem of time, which can also be seen as coming from diffeomorphism invariance, is how to find meaningful, generally covariant quantities or variables about which you can make some sort of predictions. So let me give an example of the, carrying on with this second problem. Just this maybe is something that you've discussed. Also, again, let's take an example in canonical quantum gravity. We know, I might be slightly overstating or oversimplifying the case, But suppose this was one of our observables or beables. Then think of it as an operator. We know that it has to commute with the constraint. This is my favorite symbol for commute. Another word, but if you want to write it the other way, the commutator with any of the constraints should be zero. People have different variations on this story, but something very close to this. That defines it, and if you succeed, if you get far enough and you define a physical Hilbert space and so on, maybe you have a bigger Hilbert space in which the constraints act or something. Anyway, in the end, these observables will have to be some sort of map of the physical Hilbert space into itself. And if you set up the formalism and gotten far enough in it, you may be able to identify large numbers of these mathematically. But the question is, what do they mean? First of all, it's what do they mean? And second of all, how would you translate the questions that you really want to ask into these kind of operators? For example, the question that I always think of is the question about the behavior of a horizon of a black hole. So that's something, that's kind of the worst case for something that has only space and not time because of the way the horizon is defined. You just don't know where it is. You may be able to find an apparent horizon, but you can never, if you're lucky, but you'll never find the true horizon without reference to the entire future or a large part of the future of the space-time. So that's the kind of second problem of time. Now that's also related to the diffeomorphism invariant. In the end, I hope I'll have time, I'll try and say how in the context of what's called the classical sequential growth dynamics for causal sets, how this problem is addressed and essentially completely solved, at least from a mathematical point of view. I mean, we can't yet talk about black holes because the theory isn't far enough yet. But in principle, at the classical level, the analogous problem is completely solved in a way which looks like it ought to go over to the quantum case. The third family of problems is technical problems from diffeomorphism invariants. So I'll just write that. So these were conceptual problems. The first two actually are conceptual problems from diffeomorphism invariants. Doesn't want to stay put. Yes, so for example, so here will be an example. Put that up so it doesn't get lost. So what are some examples of these? Again, the way it shows up, I mean, it's a general thing, which probably has been commented on before. There's a kind of conservation of problems. I mean, these problems tend to show up in different forms and different formulations, but it's rare that they entirely go away. So you think you've solved it, but it, you know, sneaks back in another form. So these technical problems in the path integral and in the canonical formulation do take different forms, but one arguably they're the same or almost the same problem. So, for example, in the canonical formulation, what is the inner product? How do you take two wave functions and define the physical inner product? In the path integral formulation, it's a different problem. It would be, what's the measure factor? So when I wrote the integral over all four metrics, blah, 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 we had to know with what weight to take that integral. of course, to even give this a meaning is, all, is a major work, and in, even in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, it's far from trivial. But it, but at least you can see that if you get far enough, you'll have to face this problem. Underlying this, both of these, I think, is the fact that the diffeomorphism group is not compact. It has infinite volume, but it's sort of, you might say, well, this is true even for gauge groups, because gauge groups, although SUN is compact, you don't, the gauge group of a gauge theory is not just SUN, it's an SUN at every point of space-time. And that's not really compact. So it depends, of course, what topology put on it. But the Diffeo group is worse. The diffeomorphism group is, in some sense, not even compact locally. I mean, not even at one point is it compact, because that point can move anywhere. It's, so there's something worse about it. So although they both have, in some formal way, an infinite volume, it's more under control in the case of ordinary gauge theories, and it's less under control in the case of gravity. And so it's hard to divide out by the volume of the diffeomorphism group, which is, in a path integral, what you have to do if you want to make the path integral be well-defined and finite. Because if you go back, where did I have it? If you go back to that expression, this told you to integrate over all the metrics in this region, or maybe all the metrics with a fixed volume if you're doing the unimodular case, but that's only a small difference. In either case, given any metric, you can act by a diffeomorphism that leaves the boundary unchanged, and that's a completely different metric, which you're also integrating over, but it has exactly the same physical meaning and exactly the same action. And obviously, it's going to contribute exactly the same to the integral. If you don't divide out by that volume of diffeos that you're integrating over, even though you didn't, might not have been aware of it, you'll just get this infinite multiplicative factor out in front, and you have to divide it out in order to give meaning to the integral. That's, in the case of gauge theories, there are procedures for that. It's called the Fedayeev-Popov method, for example. And there are other procedures, but let's say for Fedayeev-Popov, which give meaning to dividing out by that infinity. In the path integral, no one really knows how to do that. I suspect, maybe Lee can shed more light on this, but I suspect that, oops, this is not enough. I suspect that this problem of giving, finding the right physical inner product is closely related to that, but I that's a little bit of a guess. And do you think that that can be traced somehow to what I'm, I mean, the fact, the sort of infinite volume of the diffeomorphism group? That's not entirely clear to me, but I have to think. Okay. In any case, it certainly has something to do with the diffeomorphism group. So it is another technical problem arising from the diffeomorphism group. So these also can be seen as aspects of this problem of the time in the generalized sense. Now, I want to mention a fourth, just briefly. I'm not even sure it belongs in the list, but I think it does, which is the absence of a natural this is a purely technical problem, so it could even go under 3. Absence of a natural width rotation. I just mention it because, does everyone know, first of all, what I mean by a width rotation? Yeah, is there someone who doesn't? Okay, so I won't say what I mean by it. But the width rotation, it involves an analytic continuation of the time coordinate. If you don't know what the time coordinate is because of diffeomorphism invariance, it's clearly making life harder. Now, whether that's the root of it or not, there may be something. That's why I put a sort of question here. But let me just be generous and include this also as a problem of time. I think it's an aspect of the same general thing. And then let's go immediately to the reason that this is an important technical problem is that people often find that the mathematics of a field theory, a quantum field theory, simplifies it enormously when you make the width rotation. So basically, you change the Lorentzian signature of space-time for a Riemannian signature, and the integrands that you have to do in the path integral become positive definite, not in gravity, but in other theories, positive definite instead of indefinite. And you have a higher, I don't want to say a higher symmetry, but you don't have zero in length vectors to cause trouble. Anyway, at a technical level, this is useful. And gravity seems to resist that kind of thing. Let me jump from that to the opposite extreme of a real, almost a philosophical problem. It's not even a problem for some people, but for others, it's very serious. And so I'll call it the problem of becoming. And what does that mean? It means, do things happen? Do they really happen? Or do they just appear to happen? Is space-time just some sort of four-dimensional static thing which the future exists equally as well as the past, and it's some sort of illusion that we have that things actually change and time develops? Or is that impression we have not an illusion? Does it represent something real about nature? And if so, how is that compatible? Again, the culprit is in some sense diffeomorphism invariance, although some people claim or take the point of view that the only way to imagine things really happening is to imagine some sort of hypersurface, the now represented by space now at the moment, and imagine that hypersurface sort of making its way up through space-time. So I'll draw another picture here. A succession of moments now, you'd have to think that only this is real, only this, then later this is real. So go back to a Newtonian or Galilean idea of time. The view is expressed that that's the only way to imagine real change. And since in general relativity, there is no natural way to slice, you can't do this. Because you need some way to slice, but they can't all, if I chose a different slicing like this, they can't both be right, so the argument goes. And so none of them is right. And the only consistent view is this whole four-dimensional thing with no slices at all, and that's static and frozen. Nothing really happens. So there's no becoming, as people say, no real change. That's the argument. No, it actually doesn't even rely on the full diffeomorphism invariance. It's already present in special relativity because we still have these flat slicings, right, and then these tilted ones, and the same argument is made. So that's a kind of philosophical problem of time. And then finally, and this is not a problem of time, but I'll include it in the list. It's the arrow of time. It's it's not that it's a problem of time in the same sense, but it's more, instead of a problem, you might view it as an opportunity. Could it be that this old mystery can get some help from quantum gravity? So that's the list that I wanted to make. And so it seems now I want to start talking about how these appear in different approaches to quantum gravity, but it's most especially, of course, the path integral or the histories approach, and then see very concretely how it appears in the context of sequential growth dynamics for causal sets. So I guess it's another natural time to stop and ask a question. So we've already seen that how these problems appear, or even whether they're there, can depend on which approach you adopt to quantization. So let me just briefly review the sketch, how people have tried to quantize theories, or how they define quantum theories. This is kind of part two of the lecture. And the most basic question, which I don't think we have an answer to really yet, is what is a quantum theory? Anyway, that's posed at a very general level, but within a more limited setting, like if we ask what is a quantum theory of the electromagnetic field, or what is quantum theory of a proton and an electron or something, you can get a more definite answer. And I'll ask it in the context of a quantum field theory, because of course that's closest to what gravity is trying to be. So let me just identify, I mean, there's a whole range of different varieties and sub-approaches and so on, but let me identify these three main trends. The first one, obviously, the one we started with, is canonical quantization. What does that mean? It means you identify something like a Q and a P. You have something like the Heisenberg commutation relations. And in the end, everything looks pretty much like classical mechanics, except there are these funny non-commutativities and of course, a lot of things flow from that, but at a formal level, it looks, you have like Heisenberg, you can use the Heisenberg picture, and then these have a time dependence, and they have equations of motion. And it looks very like the equations of motion that you used to in the classical case. And so overall, you could say that what is quantum mechanics appears in this approach as a generalization. Quantum mechanics generalizes classical Hamiltonian mechanics. The second approach, of course, the one that we'll be mainly talking about in the rest of the lecture, is the path integral approach. And just remember, in a more abstract form, we saw it in the case of gravity there. In the more abstract form, you end up with something. You have some path. It may be a space-time. It may be a collection of world lines of the particles, say the electron and the nucleus and a hydrogen atom. Or it may be some more complicated thing, maybe the configuration of a gauge connection, a vector potential for a non-Abelian gauge theory on space-time, but something, I'll just call it gamma, it's the path in the path integral, also called
the history. So this is the path of the history. It's because of that terminology that is called the history that people speak of sum over histories when they talk about graph integral. So you have that, then you have some sort of integrand, and you have to do, and that gives you something. I don't want to say that all it gives you is the wave function, because if all it gave you was the wave function, then you would just be back to doing quantum canonical gravity, at least at the interpretive level, although it may be a very useful technical tool. But I'd like to think of this as more than just a useful technical tool, as being another self-freestanding, so to speak, self-supporting, independent way of thinking about quantum mechanics. Viewed in this way, quantum dynamics, I'll call it dynamics instead of mechanics, just for sake of analogy. So this generalizes canonical quantization. It's justly called quantum mechanics because it generalizes Hamiltonian mechanics. But here, I'll use the word dynamics because it's, I think, best thought of as generalizing not a mechanical theory, but a stochastic theory, like Brownian motion. So it generalizes the theory of stochastic processes, e.g. the random walk or Brownian motion. The kind of expressions you write down are exactly like you're used to seeing if you've studied stochastic processes, except you see some eyes here and a few other crucial differences. But you can think of it as a kind of generalization of these classical theories, in a certain sense as a generalization of probability theory, which is the theory that one uses to describe stochastic processes. Then the third approach, which I won't spend much time on, I also don't know a good name for it, so I've called it algebraic or quantum field theory approach. I don't have a good name. I think in some of the older things it's known as the covariant approach to quantum gravity, but that's a particularly non-descriptive name. What they mean is think of gravity as a field theory. It is indeed a classical field theory, so think of it as a classical field theory. And then try and make it into a quantum theory in the same way that you could have done for QED or for scalar field or something, namely, just convert all the field quantities to operators. So instead of having G, A, B of X, a little matrix, a little set of 10 numbers per space-time point, or if you like, a tensor, a symmetric tensor at each point of space-time, or if you even like more, you can call it the cross-section of the tensor bundle over space-time, depending how you like to talk. But anyway, these are all C numbers, they're classical. They all commute with each other. If instead of that, you could just promote this to operators, then you'd have, then instead of the Einstein equations, you have the operator Einstein equations. But that would be the only change. This is not entirely distinct from this, or this. These could be seen as particular techniques for producing these operators, if that was your point of view. This has a lot of problems. I'm not going to talk about it too much. And just as we can, everything here has a question mark. I'm not sure I've got a good name for it. I'm not so sure that this is the right way to view it. Here I think this is the right way to view canonical quantization. This is the right way to view path integral, but maybe this comes from a kind of operationalist view where these operators represent, you know, possibilities of measurements at different points in space-time. So I'll put a question mark here too. What you would have to do is go further. You'd have to introduce some sort of analogs of the Heisenberg commutation relation, G hat of X, G hat of Y. And here you might ask what you'd put here. If we were not
if we didn't have a dynamical metric, there's some very well-defined thing, which is called Pyro's bracket. That is, you don't have to go and introduce a distinguished time and go through canonical quantization as you're used to seeing it. You can do it in a fully covariant way in the context of Minkowski space. And I think, well, the one person I have in mind who's most championed this approach is Bryce DeWitt. And he certainly had in mind doing something like this. But it has problems, which I won't take the time to talk about them, but it also has some successes. In fact, you could see the so-called dynamical triangulation approach and the so-called asymptotic freedom approach as implementations of this third view. Okay. So I don't know how many people know the story of Goldilocks. I know a few people here will know, but it's about a little girl and a bear and so a family of bears and so on. And there's some things where something is too hot and too cold and just right and too big. What is it? Oatmeal. What's it? Porridge, yes, porridge. And then something. Anyway, I think this is a kind of Goldilocks story for me, which is that the first one, this is in relation to time, of course. Canonical has too little time. It has only space, basically. The third one has too much time, because it gives you the whole space-time parameter, set of four parameters in advance. In particular, it precludes topology change. But it's too much time, although the time is gauged. Anyway, this is only more in the nature of a joke than anything else. And then the second approach is just right. It has time because it has space-time, but it doesn't pin down the parameters completely as you do when you pre-specify the four manifolds, which is what has to happen in this third approach. So for the rest of the evening, or this part of the evening, I just want to talk more about the path integral approach to quantization, to quantum gravity, and then, as I said, in particular, the causal set version of the, well, I wouldn't even call it a version. Causal set has an extra element besides being a history's approach. It's a discrete approach. So. But anyway, I want to talk about the path integral approach in relation to causal sets. Okay, so let me start by saying ultimately I want to convince you that it solves most of these problems. So let's look at the potentially. Let me just stop and ask, does everyone have at least a fairly clear idea of what I mean by the path integral approach, what kind of activities we're talking about and what kind of expressions, formal operations and so on that we're talking about? Okay, so if you have that in mind, then you can try and see why it does get around some of these problems. So let's look at the problem of time, just go through them. problem of time one, what was that? Well, that was that if you had only space, it's hard to get back space time. For example, it's hard to talk about the horizon of a black hole. And of course, that's just sort of trivially solved in a sense. If we just take it exactly literally, it's trivially solved because we don't deal only with space, we deal with the space-time. The quantities that enter into the path integral are space-time or metrics on a four-dimensional manifold. Once you have the full metric, you can ask any question that has physical meaning, at least in principle. In particular, you can identify where is the horizon, if there's a black hole present, and so on. So that's, I think, for many people, certainly for me, that's the strongest motivation for going with the path integral approach. There are from other motivations coming from causal sets as well, but that's certainly a very strong motivation. And if I had limited myself to the first problem of time, we could just stop here. I could just say, okay, it's solved. End of lecture. That's the second one, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, okay, so maybe I should say something. I want to show it in some detail later for the sequential growth dynamics of causal sets. But yeah, so it's a good question. What is an observer? What is this observable slash viewable slash variable? What are the meaningful questions that you can ask about a space-time? It has to be something based on the metric. So you don't want to ask, like, what color is the space-time? Because you might have painted it, done it in colored chalk, but we don't regard that as an essential feature of the physics. So the things that you can ask have to be deducible from the metric, possibly other fields that are present in the theory. So this is sort of aside here. But not anything deducible from the metric is a meaningful question. So for example, you can't ask, what is, do I have the right thought of it? What is meaningful question? So it's some question, it has to be about the metric, but it must be independent of the coordinates that I choose to represent the metric in. Or in other words, it must be what's called covariant or on-specimen, especially like stress that it's not really covariant, it's invariant. It must be a question that has the same answer no matter what coordinate system I represent the metric in, or more generally, whatever diffeomorphism I perform on the metric field. So those are at least in the continuum, in the classical theory of general relativity, those are the observables. And they're just not easy. I mean, even the simplest things like solar system tests of general relativity, when you try and think through what you're really doing, these are very subtle questions. How you formulate these things is very subtle. For example, it's in a certain sense true that light propagating near the sun is delayed relative to what it would have done had the sun not been there. But what do we mean by that? We're saying that, well, there's some time coordinate. It started at time t0, it arrived at time t1, and there's that difference of t0 and t1. Now take the sun away. There's another time coordinate, t0, t1. The difference is greater, or less. No, difference is less now that I've taken the sun away. But that's, if I say it like that, it's entirely laden with coordinates. I mean, I could have changed. How do I know what coordinate system to use in the first place? And how do I know what coordinates in the first manifold with the sun correspond to what coordinates in the second manifold without the sun? So questions like this are very tricky. And in the actual application, of general relativity. They come up all the time. But it's something that if you work with the classical theory, you've grown, you understand how to handle pretty well. And in the quantum theory, they come back with the real vengeance. So that what we're asking for is how to get a handle on these kind of questions in the quantum theory. That's really what the problem two is. So the first problem of time is solved. The second problem of time, that's the one that Lee just highlighted, that one, I'm going to argue that in the context of classical sequential growth dynamics of causal sets, it's solved, but without going to that special context, let's just say it's ameliorated, in fancy words meaning it's made less severe. So I'm not claiming that it's completely solved, but it gets better, may be solved. Certainly, there will be, here I'm thinking of continuum path integral. There are many observables that you could write down. For example, in the context of cosmology, a particular observable would be, what's the largest size that the universe ever reaches? Here, assuming that maybe it's a kind of universe that expands from a big bang and recollapses to a big crunch. What's the largest size as measured by the largest space-like hypersurface that you can find in it? So here it's starting from a sort of big bang and big crunch. And now we're asking for the largest hypersurface we can find. This is a well-defined question. It's like, what's the longest curve between two given time-like separated points? You might think that's funny, the largest, shouldn't it be the smallest? But if you thought that, then it means you haven't really solidified your Lorentzian intuition yet. For the same reason in the twin paradox tells us that there's no shortest curve between two points, just the longest one. For the same reason there's only a biggest hypersurface in the cosmos and not a smallest. So we want the biggest three volume. So there's an observable. The magnitude of the volume of this biggest hypersurface is an observable, just one number. One can make many other observables of this sort. So there's a large supply, but are they enough? So that's a question one can raise. Are there enough to characterize the space time? Very good. No, in some sense, that's the real problem. There are no local observables. I mean, I might be slightly overstating the case, but basically what diffeomorphism invariance tells you is that the only observables are global observables, because they have to be this invariant. It has to give the same answer no matter how you represent the metric. But if here's my space-time, and I thought I had defined something locally here, by diffeomorphism, I can move this whole region over somewhere else. So local with respect to what? Right?
Some point measure the Ricci scalar. Would you come back and say, I have a...
You have to tell him or her how to find that point. So you might say, well, I have this lab or something, and I'm going to go a certain distance from this corner or something like that. Even that's a little, that could get you into trouble.
Well, listen, right there, but yes,
wherever you are, okay.
Wherever, yes.
So then you, at some particular moment on his or her clock. Okay. So then, right, so then what you've done is really produce a relative observable. That's what people are always talking about. So it's not, there's no special region of space-time which in itself can be identified by that. But you've limited your questions to space times, which have that student in it, in them. And then that defines some distinguished world line, let's say, or world two, which is the student. And there's some clock that's ticking off. Okay, so you've identified a point in the space time relative to that student. And then, of course, then it would be meaningful to say what you're asking. But the existence of that student and the definition of that point near that student is global.
Actually, the lazy student would say that locally, the universe is flat, wherever I am, and therefore R equals zero. Right?
Therefore, R equals, I don't quite understand.
Well, if the...
If the universe is...
The metric,
I didn't understand the zero.
The metric around me,
yeah,
right here, is locally flat. So R right here equals zero. That's not very good metric.
Yeah, so you can, in order for a person to exist, the metric has to be locally flat to some approximation, or they'll be ripped apart by the tidal forces. So by specifying it as a student, you would specify the fair degree of flatness and so on. So, but all those things are all global statements about what the metric is like. We don't know how to formulate them in a truly local form. If you could assume there was always a student in every space-time, then you'd have something like a distinguished coordinate system. You could fix the gauge relative to that student. But of course there isn't. And of course the really interesting questions that we want to ask are about regimes where the student couldn't possibly exist. Like we want to ask about quantum cosmology. We want to what happens to someone who falls into a black hole and gets near the singularity. Those are the cases. Those are situations, or one asks what happens on very, very small scales, or the Planck scale of the vacuum. Those are all the situations where we believe quantum gravity will be important. And there may be others, of course. But those are some that it's natural to expect where it'll have its applications. And those are ones in which there's nothing like a student, and there's nothing that you could presume to give yourself a fixed reference frame.
Right. The path integral itself is a non-local formula.
In the path integral itself, exactly. Well, so that's right. So quantum mechanics itself is in some radical sense non-local because it involves space-time amplitudes, not local amplitudes. As you said, the wave function is a non-local thing. It's a non-local thing. And that's from a path integral point of view because the path integral itself, to get the amplitude, you need the whole trajectory, the whole history. Yeah. Any other questions? Maybe I should. So I rush a little bit now because I'm going out of time to do the causal sets. So problem time three, what was that? That was technical problem. Well, maybe some help there, but without leaving the continuum, I think it's still a lot of technical problems. If you want to see an example, if you want to see an illustration of a situation in which the path integral seems to allow you to say the kind of thing you'd like to say, where in contrast to a canonical approach, I'll just mention a paper that I wrote with Daniel Swiderski. It's called something like large fluctuations in the entropy or something. It's about black holes formed by quantum processes. I won't try to say too much about it, except it illustrates where the path integral, it illustrates in a little more detail some of the points I was trying to make. But because in a path integral formulation, you have a whole space-time available, you can talk about things like horizons and their properties in a those things become more accessible than they are when you have to talk about just data on a space like hypersurface. Okay, I said this before, but let me just say it again briefly. What I mean by a path integral or history's formulation. Part of what I said is I don't know fully what I mean by it, but what do I want it to be? I want a history's formulation that's freestanding. In other words, you don't have to think of it as just a propagator. Which forces us back to thinking about the wave function. It just gives you the wave function at one time from another time. We need to free. This could be a pun. We need to free the path integral from the wave function. Actually, if you look at it on my web page or in the archive, you can see some article I wrote recently called something like quantum mechanics without the wave function, or something like that, which would probably hopefully give a clearer idea of what I'm talking about. There's a lot of work is done in this direction, so I just mentioned these again without going into them. One is called Decoherent Histories Approach, which is an attempt to make a histories approach of the sort I'm talking about, based on the idea of decoherence. I'm not necessarily advocating that, but you'll see what it means to have a histories approach. So another decoherent functional quantum measure, these are words that come up. And you meet, ultimately, when you've done this, hopefully, we want to ask, what is a quantum space-time? What do we really mean by it? What is a quantum anything? Electron, what is a quantum, more generally, what is a quantum reality? And so I'll just put this code word. I left out some sort of an homomorphic coordinates. Okay. This is just meant to suggest that there are some proposed answers to these questions. But at this point, we still have to say that these remain questions. We don't have a fully complete understanding of quantum mechanics in terms of histories and path integrals in the same way that you have an understanding of non-relativistic quantum mechanics in terms of operators and unitary maps and so on. For those who know a little bit about this, I just raise a problem, not a problem, a question that I think there's something that I think people should think about that they haven't thought about. It doesn't require a lot of technical know-how to think about necessarily. It's just something that because people don't think in along these lines, they haven't addressed. It may not be clear to you what I'm asking, but I just want to write it down. Afterwards, I can try and describe more. So there's something called the decoherence functional in all these approaches in histories. And I'm asking, what is it? I just mean, even formally, how do you write it down? This has to do with very much about the questions of observables. Let me not say too much, but what I'm trying to say is I think there's a fairly well-posed problem that you can think about, people can think about crucially, and people haven't thought about. And it's a stepping stone. It's a necessary, answering that is a necessary step in coming up with some continuum formula, some continuum history story about gravity. Maybe, as I think, only an approximation to a discrete story, but nevertheless, it has to be there. And if we could answer this question, it would be an important clue for formulating even a discrete theory. So,
question?
Yes.
So what is really the abstraction to write down a decoherence functional? I mean, I don't see what's the problem with it.
Well, some of the problems would be it should be not infinite. It should make sense in a semi-classical situation. You should say what sets of histories are involved in the decoherence. I mean, we can talk about it later, but if you think you have an answer, we can discuss it.
No,
it partly has to do with, are you asking what is a decoherence function?
No, it was an honest question. I don't know. I don't have any idea how you
could
write it down.
Oh, I see. I thought you said what was the problem? Like,
yeah, no. So
isn't it obvious what the decoherence?
Yeah. So what was the abstraction? But then, I mean, as soon as you have an inner product, I would have thought you could write down a
decoherence function. Well, first of all, we don't have an inner product. What do you mean by an inner product? See, we're not starting even with a wave function. Let me jump up and down and try and hammer on that point as much as possible. We're starting just with a space of histories and nothing else. and maybe a Lagrangian, and we want to write down a decoherence functional on that history space. The inner product might play a role somewhere. I'm not forbidding you to use an inner product. But if you have an inner product, then what? You have to have a Hilbert space. I mean, you have to. And we know that that's hard. We don't, and Lee just told us that we don't really know in the end what the physical inner product is in some approach. And I'm not, well, maybe there are arguably you know formally what it is. Anyway, we can talk. Maybe, I don't want to rule out that there's there is the right answer that some people know and that I don't know, but in any case, I think I've never seen people raise some of the questions that seem to me to be getting in the way of it. A lot of them have to do with the semi-classical limits. Okay, so let me go to part three, since I'm running short on time. Let me go to part three, which is this lecture, which is on causal sets. Of course, I can give two more lectures just on causal sets, or many more, but just even to introduce the idea properly. I can't introduce the idea properly here, I think. So I have to assume that you know at least something about them. What I do want to show, of course, it's meant to be a theory, an approach to quantum gravity. But what's interesting also about it is that the concepts are rather simple, and the underlying concepts are rather simple, and they make a natural laboratory for addressing some of these problems that we've identified here in a rather abstract way. I think in earlier meetings of the course, you've addressed them concretely in the context of canonical quantum gravity. And now I want to address them concretely in the context of a path integral-like approach to quantum gravity. Without dragging in all of the technical problems that the continuum path integral has, of course, one of the points of causal sets is that the discreteness is supposed to make a lot of those technical problems go away. So I'm going to give like a 5-minute review or introduction to causal sets, but really meant for people who have some familiarity. I mean, if you've never seen it before, you probably won't get too much out of the review. I hope a little bit, anyway. So it helps to cure just because it's discrete, it helps to cure the divergences of and the singularities of continuum theories. It explains the metric, that is, where is length coming from? And in particular, it explains, I don't mean to say it predicts four dimensions, but it explains why the signature is Lorentzian. Causal set is something very simple, basically a set of elements with an order relation. Because they're discrete, you can count them. Then putting that order information together with the counting information gives you, under certain appropriate circumstances, geometry. So here's a slogan of how space-time is meant to come out of a causal set. Let me just define for you a causal set. So it's a set of elements. It has an order relation. So you can think of these as kind of discrete atoms of space-time or elements of space-time. And this means that X precedes Y. It's to the past of Y. In the context of the growth dynamics that I will talk about, X is an ancestor of Y will be another way of saying the same thing. But mathematically, it's just an order relationship. So, and in the space-time, it corresponds to the before and after. So it just means if this is X, it means Y is within or on the light, future light cone of X. It has to be transitive. So that means X precedes Y precedes Z, implies X precedes Z. And it has to be, this doesn't work. It has to be acyclic, as it's called.
which in this case I'll just take it to mean the following thing, that x does not precede itself. That's a little stronger. And then it has to be, so this is not equal to, this is implied by a sequence, but I'll assume this. And then it has to be, we have to say it's discrete. So far, if I took elements of the causal set to be the points of Minkowski space, say, they would satisfy all these. But now we're going to make it discrete, which is past finite, which is appropriate for cosmology, and it's true in the model that I'm going to be talking about, this sequential growth models. So past finite means that each element has at most a finite number of ancestors. Its past is finite, okay. Finite number of elements. Yeah, in other contexts, is a more general thing where you define it to be locally finite. That's somewhat more general, and it would allow Minkowski, something like Minkowski space, whereas this will allow only something like a cosmological solution that starts from a sort of empty set. No, they're all in the same coset, but they just are unrelated causally to each other. So just like this. So think of it as the idea is that what we experience as space-time is deep down a causal set. And there's some rough correspondence between elements of the causal set and certain points of the space-time. And if the elements are space-like separated, if the elements are unrelated, neither precedes the other, then the points to which they would correspond in the space-time are just space-like conditions. But they're still in the same causal set. So for example, it could happen that X precedes, and that what can tie them together is their relation to a third element. So it can happen that they both have a common descendant Z, even though they're unrelated to each other. So that would be like in a diamond. What do I want? This would be X, this would Y, this would be Z. This could be, say, U. Okay, so here are two elements. This is called a Hasse diagram, but which mathematicians use to express partially ordered sets. Fortunately, it's just a discrete space-time diagram, so we already understand it. And this says that X and Y are unrelated space-like. But here's an example where they have a common ancestor, U, and a common descendant, Z. As long as there's no, well, even if there, yeah, even if there's a horizon, that can still happen. If Z was inside the horizon. Yeah. But you could cook up a space-time in which there's no common descendant. But if there, remember, Y is not a person. It's not a world line. It's just an element. It's like it's a space, an event. It's like a point event. So to say it's accelerating has no meaning. That's just saying how you wish to identify it with other elements. What should I do? Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's fine, but I thought you wanted to. Okay. Well, that's fine. Sure. And we may be able to finish a bit early. Sure.